Okay. Welcome. My name is Divine. This is our current episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be doing something called a rapid review of gram positives. Okay, so this is a micro podcast. This is attuned specifically to a person that's taking like a micro quiz or micro exam in your first 2 years of med school, or if you're preparing for step one and you want to very quickly review the gram positives, this will be a very nice way to do that. And basically, the way I'm going to make this podcast is I'm going to stare at the gram positive algorithm in first aid and then just say all the high yield things that are classically tested with the different bugs. So we know obviously, right, that we're dealing with bacteria here, right? You start with the gram stain. Right, and we know that there's you could have organisms that are gram positive or gram negative, right? And I mean, sort of key things you want to know, right? So gram positive organisms, right, they stain purple, right? That's easy enough, versus the gram negatives that stain pink, right? And the thing is, if you're comparing your gram positives and gram negatives, you know that your gram positives in general, they have a thicker peptidoglycan cell layer. So because they have that thicker peptidoglycan cell layer, right, they stain purple with the gram stain, right? But they do not have an outer membrane, in contrast with your gram negatives that have both an inner membrane and an outer membrane. An inner membrane is found in both gram positives and gram negatives, but an outer membrane is found specifically in gram negatives, right? And the thing is, between that inner and outer membrane, if you're talking about gram negatives, right, there is this space. It's called, I sort of think of it as like a storage warehouse. It's called the periplasmic space. And that periplasmic space is very high yield because it contains this enzyme known as beta-lactamase, right? And beta-lactamase, super high yield enzyme. It breaks down beta-lactam antibiotics. And I'll talk about that at the end when I give a very quick, brief spiel on antibiotics. Now, your gram positives, right? You want to sort of know, okay, why are they bad, right? The reason gram positives are bad is that they have something called a lipoteichoic acid, right, in their cell membranes. And those things can sort of trigger your immune system, right? You can release all these acute phase reactants and get into a lot of trouble. And gram positives in general, right, they have exotoxin. Exotoxin, yes, I know there's gram negatives that make exotoxin, but whenever you see exotoxin, think more about gram positives versus gram negatives that tend to make endotoxin. The big one you probably want to know is LPS, right? Lipopolysaccharide. It has like something known as lipid A, and that thing sort of triggers your immune system. In fact, I will say that lipopolysaccharide, if you're thinking in terms of immunology, it's an example of a PAMP, right? So PAMP, I don't mean PIMP. Don't think of wrong things. PAMP. PAMP is like a pathogen associated molecular pattern. Okay, so PAMPs, they're basically things that you can say your innate immune system can say, oh wait, this thing is a bacteria, right? So lipopolysaccharide is an example of a PAMP, and it binds to CD14, right, on macrophages, and it can basically trigger a signaling cascade that can upregulate NF-kappa-B. And then through NF-kappa-B, you can begin to make some high-yield acute phase cytokines like IL-1 and IL-6, right? And also through that signaling cascade, you break down something known as I-kappa-B. I-kappa-B is something that actually degrades and sort of shuts down NF-kappa-B. So if you degrade I-kappa-B, NF-kappa-B can run wild and you make all those acute phase cytokines. So LPS is an endotoxin. So think about endotoxin with regards to gram negatives. Think about exotoxin with regards to gram positives. So if you're talking about gram positives, right, the first thing you want to do is you want to break them up as being like bacilli, so basically rods, right, or cocci. Those are basically your circles, right? And then you can also have the branching filaments, and we'll talk about those in a bit, right? So if you're talking about your cocci, right, the next test you go for is your catalase test. Remember, catalase is part of your respiratory burst pathway, right? It breaks down hydrogen peroxide to water and oxygen. And hopefully you remember that if a patient has an NADPH oxidase deficiency, right, they will have no ability to make hydrogen peroxide. And if they cannot make hydrogen peroxide, they become susceptible to organisms that are catalase positive, right? So organisms like Staph aureus, for example, right? Like E. coli, like Candida, like Aspergillus, like Klebsiella, right? Those people can get very severe infections. Patients that have a chronic granulomatous disease. Now, so back to our spiel, right? So if you're talking about the gram-positive coxa, right, your circles, right, you can say, okay, are they catalase positive or negative, right? If you say they're catalase positive, that means you're dealing with Staph aureus, right? You're dealing with Staph aureus. I mean, you're dealing with Staph species in general, right? And then if you say, okay, let's break down the Staph species, let's make a more granular representation, right? Because there are multiple Staph species. There's like Staph aureus, there's Staph epidermidis, there is Staph saprophyticus. Staph aureus has the added property of being coagulase positive. You may say, Divine, no, who cares about coagulase? Why do we need coagulase? Well, the thing is, coagulase, it actually binds to factor 2, so like thrombin. It sort of forms a complex with it, and then you'll learn about that when you study hemonc, and I'll talk about that when I do the hemonc podcast. But basically, coagulase, right, it binds to thrombin and basically converts fibrinogen to fibrin, right? That complex that it forms with thrombin converts fibrinogen, which is factor 1, to fibrin, right, which is the activated form of factor 1. And by having that fibrin around the Staph aureus, it basically sort of hides it from the immune system, makes it very difficult for your immune systems to gain immune system to gain access to the bug. So Staph aureus is catalase positive and coagulase positive, right? So what are some high-yield things you want to know for your exam with regards to Staph aureus? One high-yield thing you want to know is that Staph aureus has something known as protein A, right? And that protein A is kind of high-yield in the sense that it is very good at binding to the constant region of IgG. And when it binds to that constant region of IgG, you cannot have phagocytosis, right? Because remember, that constant region is usually bound by the phagocytic cell, like a macrophage or something, that then goes up and gobbles up that the organism that has been bound by the variable region, right? So if you have protein A, you bind to that constant region of IgG, you're basically preventing a phagocytosis in a sense. Now, if other high-yield things you want to know about Staph aureus, right? So Staph aureus can cause a lot of problems, right? So it can cause certain skin infections. The classic one is impetigo, right? So impetigo, the classic presentation on exams will be like an infection on the face, usually in kids on exams. And you see like those are honey color crusted lesions, right? If you ever see that, think about impetigo. Impetigo is classically caused by Staph aureus. Yes, I know some of you may say, oh, come on, Divine. Impetigo can also be caused by group A strep, right? So strep pyogenes. That is true. But on exams, if you're presented with both possibilities, go with Staph aureus. Staph aureus is probably a more common cause of impetigo compared with group A strep. Contrast that with erysipelas, right? So erysipelas, they are not the honey colored crusted business that you find with impetigo. Erysipelas are more like very painful, acute onset, red lesions. They are very well demarcated and they are usually elevated relative to the surrounding skin. Those can be caused by Staph aureus and group A strep. But on exams, if you're presented with both possibilities, go with group A strep. Okay, group A strep more commonly on exams causes erysipelas. So, what are some other high-yield things about Staph aureus, right? So Staph aureus can cause, it can produce a super antigen, right? The classic one on exams is a TSST1, right? So you may say, oh, Divine, you're throwing all these immunology terms, right? So what's a super antigen, right? The thing is basically a super antigen is something that sort of binds to MHC2. And a specific portion of the T cell receptor. It's called like the V beta region. So it binds those two things and non-specifically causes like a massive, massive, massive release of cytokines. When you release all those cytokines, well, guess what? You go into shock, right? So like your liver enzymes will go up, the patient will be profoundly hypotensive and all that stuff. It's just a bad situation, right? So in general, Staph aureus can cause that. Also, strep pyogenes can also cause a toxic shock syndrome. And the classic way toxic shock syndrome will present on exams, they'll talk about a lady, right, that has been having a period and then she has had tampons inserted for like a long period of time. Or it can be a person that had like very bad nasal infection, or like bleeding from their nose, and then they've been using like a lot of like nasal packing. You sort of like grow staph aureus in those areas, and then you make those super antigens, and then you get into trouble. And then staph aureus, right, classically, in fact, I will say it's very high yield to know this, staph aureus is the most common cause, very high yield, it's the most common cause of acute endocarditis. And I mean the classic patient population there are the IV drug users, right? And I mean, like, what valve would, if you were to hazard a guess, like, oh, what's the valve that will be affected by staph aureus, right, on an exam, right? I hope you're thinking more about the tricuspid valve, right? Remember, the tricuspid valve is between the right atrium and the right ventricle. And you may say, Divine, come on, why is it not the mitral valve? Why is it just the tricuspid? I mean, obviously, staph aureus can affect any valve. But think about it, if you're an IV drug user, right? Where are you injecting all those IV drugs into? Into a vein, right? Intravenous, right? And where do veins drain to, right? Veins drain to the right side of the heart, right? And the right side of the heart is what contains the tricuspid valve. So that is why classically, staph aureus, tricuspid valve endocarditis, okay? Acute endocarditis. Staph aureus is the most common cause of acute endocarditis. And the thing is, staph aureus can damage a valve that is a-okay from the beginning. So you have like a good pristine valve, staph aureus can damage that. Contrast that with subacute endocarditis, where usually you have like some valvular problem. Either you have like a prosthetic valve in place, or you have a valve that is already not working very well. That is where you can get into trouble. And subacute endocarditis is most commonly caused by strep viridans. I'll talk about that when we get to the catalase negative part of this Coxsi algorithm. So, staph aureus, acute endocarditis, right? And let's see, what are the other high yield things we should probably know about staph aureus? Staph aureus can cause osteomyelitis. In fact, it's the most common cause of osteomyelitis, right? Staph aureus is the most common cause of osteomyelitis. And then some other things you want to think about, right? If they give you a question, say, for example, about a patient, about a person that has really bad watery diarrhea and vomiting, right? And they tell you that, oh, the person recently, they say like 2 to 6 hours ago, recently ate like mayonnaise or custard or salads that were left out for long, right? Like unrefrigerated, just left out in the open. Usually it's at a picnic on exams. Think about staph aureus as the offending organism, right? So staph aureus can sort of make a certain, like a preformed toxin, right? That preformed toxin is actually heat stable. So you can make a preformed toxin, sort of settles out in that food. You eat that food and then you get into trouble very, very quickly, right? And the thing is, I just said that the most common cause of osteomyelitis is staph aureus, right? But what if they give you a question about a patient that has sickle cell disease and they have osteomyelitis? What's the bug you're thinking about? I really, really hope you're not thinking about staph aureus. I really hope you're thinking more along the lines of a salmonella, okay? Salmonella is the most common cause of osteomyelitis, especially in the sickle cell population. Now, other high-yield things about staph aureus, right? So I already said it's catalase positive, it's coagulase positive. Another weird thing I guess you can keep in mind is that it ferments mannitol, okay? And it's also beta-hemolytic, just like group A and group B strep. Okay, just one of those other weird things you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind. And thinking more along the lines of step one, the thing is, staph aureus is actually the most common cause of pneumonia in patients with cystic fibrosis up until the age of 18. You may say, Divine, everywhere I've heard is like, oh, most common cause of pneumonia, cystic fibrosis patients is Pseudomonas. That is not true. The most common cause, this is very high yield for exams, the most common cause of pneumonia in cystic fibrosis patients prior to the age of 18 is staph aureus. But past the age of 18, it then becomes Pseudomonas, right? And then one other bug I guess you may hear of on exams that may cause a pneumonia in cystic fibrosis patients is a bug known as a Burkholderia, Burkholderia, Burkholderia sepecia. It's also it's a less common cause of pneumonia in CF patients compared with staph aureus and Pseudomonas. So again, those are weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And then Don't forget that you can also, there's this exfoliative toxin that is made by staph aureus that can also cause something called like the triple S syndrome, if you may, scalded skin syndrome. Now, how do we treat staph, right? So the thing is, staph, on your exam, you probably want to keep certain things at the back of your mind, right? So the thing is, staph, there's MSSA. I'll see the two big groups you want to know on your exams. There's MSSA and there's MRSA, right? So MSSA stands for methicillin-sensitive staph aureus, and then MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant staph aureus. The thing is, to avoid jumbling things together, I'll talk about the antibiotics at the end, but I'll just tell you in general, right? If you want to cover MSSA, you want to use drugs like nafcillin or oxacillin or dicloxacillin. Don't choose methicillin on your exams. No one uses methicillin anymore, because it causes something called acute interstitial nephritis. It's something you'll learn about in an immunology block or in a renal block. You'll learn about it in an immunology block, because that is one cause of eosinophilia, right? So classically, right, EIN will present as like patient that has like a fever. They recently have started some kind of antibiotic. They may have started like oxacillin for like mastitis, for example. I'll just throw this in there. Staph aureus is the most common cause of mastitis. Mastitis is just a breast infection. So they probably just took like oxacillin or dicloxacillin for mastitis, and then they started having a high fever, and then they have like a rash, and then you find like elevated levels of eosinophils in their blood and their urine. If you see that, think about acute interstitial nephritis. That's a classic side effect associated with anti-staphylococcal penicillins, especially the ones that are the MSSA covering penicillins, right? So again, like nafcillin, dicloxacillin, and oxacillin. Those drugs, classically on exams, they will try to trick you by saying, oh, what is the like nafcillin, for example, is it how can a person go from MSSA to MRSA? So what's like the mechanism of resistance that basically makes staph aureus methicillin resistant? The thing is, it is very high yield to know that it is an alteration in the penicillin binding protein. And again, I will say more things about this down the line, but basically you have an altered structure of transpeptides. That is what makes staph aureus MRSA, not MSSA. And it's very high yield to know that the MSSA covering medications like nafcillin, oxacillin, and whatnot, they're actually resistant to beta-lactamase. So those drugs are not broken down by beta-lactamase. Very high yield to know that for exams. And then if you talk about MRSA, right, you want to know the drugs that cover MRSA, right? So classically, you want to know drugs like vancomycin. Vancomycin covers MRSA. Tigecycline is a kind of it's a kind of tetracycline, but it's like a super new, very advanced tetracycline. In fact, it belongs to a drug class known as the glycycyclines. Those are very good at covering MRSA. There is a cephalosporin, a fifth generation cephalosporin known as ceftaroline. It's very good at covering MRSA. There is a drug known as daptomycin. Daptomycin is one of those weird drugs that sort of inserts holes in the walls of a bacteria, gram positives to be more specific. Daptomycin covers MRSA. Linezolid is a 50S inhibitor. It's a bacteriostatic 50S inhibitor. It's also very good at covering MRSA, and also I guess a vancomycin resistant enterococcus. And then there is one other drug I'm forgetting right now. Vancomycin, obviously, right, covers MRSA. Okay. So I think that's all I'm going to say about staph aureus. If we're sort of jumping to the other staph species, right? So we have like staph epidermidis, right? Staph epidermidis, the big thing you want to know about it for exams is that if a patient has like plastic, right? So say like, let's say they have like a prosthetic valve or a Foley catheter, and let's say they have like a UTI from a Foley catheter, or they have like prosthetic valve endocarditis. Think about staph epidermidis. Staph epidermidis, it's actually a normal part of your skin flora, but it's a fairly common contaminant in blood cultures, right? So if you grow staph epidermidis from blood, it's probably a contaminant. And staph epidermidis, one test that you could use to identify it is that it is a novobiocin sensitive. That's just one weird thing you want to know about staph epidermidis. And the reason staph epidermidis loves plastic is because it makes kind of like a loosey-goosey capsule. The boss phrase you want to know for exams is a biofilm, right? So because it makes that biofilm, it sticks to plastic really well, right? And because it sticks to plastic really well, it's just very hard to get, it just loves plastic, right? So that's why it can cause infections, especially when a person has like plastic somewhere in their bodies. Now, contrast Staph epidermidis with Staph saprophyticus. Staph saprophyticus, the way it's classically tested is in a few scenarios, right? So one, let me ask one question first. What is the most common cause of UTIs? What is the organism that most commonly causes UTIs, right? I hope you are responding E. coli, right? E. coli is the most common cause of UTIs. Now, what is the second most common cause of UTIs? That is Staph saprophyticus, okay? And the thing is, unlike Staph epidermidis, that is novobiocin sensitive, Staph saprophyticus is novobiocin resistant, right? And the thing is, classically on exams, if they describe like a female that just newly became sexually active and she has a UTI, you probably want to go ahead and pick Staph saprophyticus on your exam as the answer. And one other weird thing to keep in mind with regards to Staph saprophyticus is that there's this enzyme it produces, urease, right? So Staph saprophyticus produces urease. For some bizarre reason, urease producing organisms are high yield to know for many exams, especially step one, right? So Staph saprophyticus is urease positive. Another classic one, probably the highest yield of them all, is H. pylori, right? H. pylori is urease positive. That's why it can sort of survive in the acidic stomach, acidic environment of the stomach. Another high yield one is ureplasma, urolyticum. That one also causes UTIs. And then another weird one is Proteus mirabilis. Proteus, it causes a lot of UTIs, right? And especially if a person has a UTI and their urine has like a super high pH, think about Proteus mirabilis. Classically, it's that thing that grows with a swarming motility on agar. It's just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So I think that is all I'm going to say about the Staph species. So I'm going to go down the strep pathway. The strep pathway. So for the strep pathway, right? So all strep species are catalase negative, right? So the next thing you want to, next test you want to order is, oh, what's the hemolytic pattern, right? So it's either alpha hemolysis, is it beta hemolysis, is it gamma hemolysis, right? So the thing is, let's start with the alpha hemolytic strep. I'm just looking at this first state table of gram positives, and I'm just, again, literally, like I said, I'm just going to be reeling off the high yield information for each bug on the algorithm, so you can sort of listen to this podcast as like a very quick rapid review before an exam. So if we're talking about alpha hemolysis, right? So alpha hemolysis is basically partial hemolysis, and that partial hemolysis refers to blood agar, right? So like you're partially hemolyzing blood agar. That is what ascribes a strep species as being alpha hemolytic. And the thing is, under the alpha hemolytic streps, there's two big ones you want to know, right? So you want to know strep viridans and strep pneumo, right? So strep pneumo and strep viridans. Now there's this test, right? I guess while we're on this topic, let's sort of talk about key differences between strep viridans and strep pneumo, right? So the thing is, between these two, it's very high yield to know that strep pneumo has a capsule, right? And the thing is, strep pneumo, right? So this is why strep pneumo is not a big constituent of your GI flora. Right, the thing is, strep pneumo is basically exploded by bile, right? So it's soluble in bile, it does not grow in bile, okay? And then optochin, strep pneumo is also sensitive to optochin. This is a very low yield test, rarely if ever shows up on exams, but I'll just throw that in there just for completeness sake. But the big things you want to know about strep pneumo is it is soluble in bile, so it cannot grow in bile. And it has a capsule, right? Contrast that with strep viridans. Strep viridans can grow very nicely in bile, okay? Strep viridans actually has no capsule versus strep pneumo that actually has a capsule. And strep viridans is resistant to optochin. And I guess since I'm making this big fuss about capsules, right? It's very high yield to know the organisms that are encapsulated, right? So let me try to introduce these organisms with vignettes, right? So let's assume you get a question about a patient that has pneumonia, and that pneumonia contains rust-colored sputum, right? I hope you're thinking about strep pneumo. Strep pneumo is encapsulated. What if you get a question about a patient that recently came back from Mexico, right? And they have like very bad, like 3-4 day watery diarrhea. I hope you're thinking about traveler's diarrhea, right? Caused by ETEC, enterotoxigenic E. coli. Another name for that is like Montezuma's Revenge, right? That's E. coli, ETEC, right? ETEC. Remember, it has two toxins, right? It has like the a heat stable toxin that activates a cyclic GMP and a heat labile toxin that activates a cyclic AMP. There's like a mnemonic, labile as the air, stable as the ground, blah-de-blah-de-blah. I could use to remember that. But basically, ETEC, right? Like all E. coli species has a capsule. What if you get a question about a patient that has a pneumonia and their sputum is currant jelly? Like, if you see that, I hope you're thinking about Klebsiella pneumoniae. Classically, that's in alcoholics. Klebsiella species are also encapsulated. Remember, another high yield disease causing Klebsiella species is what is it called? Klebsiella granulomatis. It causes granuloma inguinale. It's like a painless ulcer around the genitals. It's a weird thing to keep in mind for exams. Let me give you another one. What if you get a question about a patient, right, that has like their pinna, like the pinna of their external ears hurt a lot, and let's say they're from California and they swim a ton, right? Hopefully that gets you thinking of Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Also produces a capsules. Now, what if you get a question about a college student that has like a 12-hour history of super high fever and nuchal rigidity and has a severe headache? Hopefully you're thinking about Neisseria meningitis. Remember, that's a gram-negative diplococcus. Neisseria meningitis does have a capsule. Please don't confuse that with Neisseria gonorrhea. Neisseria gonorrhea does not have a capsule. Neisseria meningitis does. I remember, you treat that with ceftriaxone. Let's see. What if you get a question about a patient that has... let's just put it this way. Okay, what if you get a question about a patient and they have... it's like a kid, like a five-year-old, and they have a really bad upper respiratory infection, and they're sort of tripoding, and they're sort of taking like this dog sniffing position in like dog sniffing position. And then let's assume you do like a lateral neck x-ray, right? And you see something known as the thumb sign. And let's assume this person has not gotten their vaccination. Let's assume they're like an anti-vaxxer child. Hopefully you're thinking about H-flu and epiglottitis. H-flu used to be the most common cause of epiglottitis back in the day when there was no vaccine for it. But now H-flu now has a conjugate vaccine. Very high yield to know that has a conjugate vaccine. And because of that, in fact, the incidence of epiglottitis has gone down quite significantly just because of that. H-flu is an encapsulated bug. What if you get a question about a child that is 14 days old and has meningitis, right? Hopefully you're thinking about Grubby strep, right? Strepigalactiae. Strepigalactiae is another encapsulated organism. Okay, let's sort of get back into things here. But those are the high-yield encapsulated organisms to know, right? So like E. coli, strep pneumo, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas, H-flu, Neisseria meningitis, Grubby strep. Very high-yield ones to know for tests. An encapsulated, fungus that you probably want to know is, what is the name of this thing that causes meningitis in AIDS patients? Cryptococcus neoformans, right? That's another encapsulated organism. Okay, remember the India ink stain with that, or the Lydex particle agglutination assay. Okay, back to this. So we're still under the purview of alpha hemolysis, right? And we're talking about strep pneumo and strep viridans, right? So let's talk about strep pneumo first. It's probably the highest yield one to know for exams, right? So we know that strep pneumo, right? It's the most common cause of pneumonia. Right, is the most common cause of sinusitis, is the most common cause of meningitis, is the most common cause of otitis media. So initially it was strep pneumo, and then it became non-typeable H flu. But last I checked, the most common cause of otitis media these days is it's kind of like a tussle between strep pneumo and Moraxella catarrhalis. But if I were you on exams, probably go ahead and go with a strep pneumo, right? And the classic way that will present on exams is like an erythematous bulging tympanic membrane in a kid. If you see that, think about otitis media, right? Now, so strep pneumo, right? So we know that strep pneumo loves to cause upper respiratory infections, right? So you may say, Divine, why does strep pneumo love to cause upper respiratory infections? Well, the thing is, it can survive very nicely in your respiratory tract, right? So let's sort of take a step back to immunology to understand why this may be the case, right? So in your immunology course, right, you probably learned about a particular immunoglobulin that has a secretory component that helps sort of protect it against the rough neighborhood of mucosa, but it's like the guardian of your mucosa. What's the immunoglobulin I'm talking about? I hope you're seeing IgA, right? The thing is, if you want to be any kind of noteworthy respiratory tract bug, you need to have something that can destroy that IgA so that you can sort of live freely in the respiratory tract. And the thing that destroys that IgA is easy enough, known as IgA protease. IgA protease is made by strep pneumo, and it helps it destroy IgA. Another high yield thing you want to know about strep, another bug you want to know that actually has that IgA protease is also Neisseria meningitidis. Neisseria meningitidis, remember, it actually, the route of spread is through like respiratory droplets. It actually does have IgA protease as well. And as far as I know, H flu also has IgA protease. And just please, this misconception that many people get wrong on exams for some reason. H flu does not cause the flu, okay? The flu is caused by the influenza virus, okay? H flu does not cause the flu. H flu, like I said, commonly causes like otitis media, but it can also, especially the non-typeable form, and there's a particular Haemophilus species that can also cause like genital infections, like painful ulcers in the genitals, Haemophilus ducreyi. I think there's like a nice mnemonic for that Haemophilus ducreyi makes you cry, to help you remember that it causes painful ulcers on the genitals. So back to the real world, right? So strep pneumo, right? So strep pneumo has IgA protease, right? And again, it's catalase negative, right? So if you have CGD, you will not have issues with strep pneumo. But some other high yield things you want to know about strep pneumo, right? So strep pneumo, it can cause a lot of problems in people that don't have spleens. So guess what? Who are the people that don't have spleens on exams? Those are patients with sickle cell. Remember, those sickle cells can basically like kill their spleens from like auto infarction of their spleens. So strep pneumo can cause like very bad sepsis in patients with sickle cell disease. In fact, if a patient has sickle cell disease, you classically have to place them on like penicillin prophylaxis for like their first 5 or 7 years of life, so that they don't get into trouble. Okay, now strep pneumo, right? Like I said, it spread through respiratory droplets, and it's the most common cause of pneumonia, right? So it causes like a lobar pneumonia. So if you see like consolidation chest X-ray, think about strep pneumo versus the more atypical causes of pneumonia like mycoplasma or chlamydia or legionella. Those tend to cause more along the lines of interstitial pneumonias, right? Those interstitial pneumonias, you tend to have like more like interstitial spread on chest X-ray versus like a lobar consolidation. And again, strep pneumo has a capsule, right? So again, if you don't have a spleen, you have a lot of trouble dealing with encapsulated organisms. So I can envision a very good USMLE step one question where they basically describe a person that has, basically describe a person, history of sickle cell disease. They say they have like a very severe infection, and then they give you a list of bugs as answer choices, as like the potential causes of that infection. And there'll be one encapsulated bug, and there'll be like five or six unencapsulated bugs, right? So that's why you want to know the bugs that are encapsulated for exams. And strep pneumo, right, causes pneumonia classically with the rust-colored sputum, right? And the thing is, if you get a question about a patient that has strep pneumo and they have meningitis as a result of that, just for purposes of the future, especially for step one, in addition to treating those people with antibiotic, you need to add steroids, right? Because strep pneumo meningitis can ultimately cause hearing loss and just some other like just bad problems. So you want to sort of give steroids to decrease the inflammation. Really helps if a person has a strep pneumo meningitis. And again, because strep pneumo has a capsule, right, there is a particular test you may be able to use to detect encapsulated organisms like strep pneumo. Well, I hope you're thinking about the Quelong reaction. The Quelong reaction is a very nice test to detect encapsulated organisms, although in the real world, no one really does that anymore. And in general, how do you treat strep pneumo? Right, you can give like a cephalosporin like ceftriaxone. You generally do not give like straight up penicillin for strep pneumo because there's almost like 100% resistance these days. If it's otitis media, you want to give your aminopenicillins, right? So like amoxicillin, or you can give amoxicillin combined with clavulanic acid, right? So like augmentin. I'll talk about those as we proceed to down the line with antibiotics, although I already described these in like excruciating detail in my antibiotic podcasts. So what else do I want to say about strep pneumo? There are actually vaccines to strep pneumo, and they're kind of high yield to know for exams, right? So there's like the PCV13, and then there is the PPSV23. Right, so the thing is, the PCV13 vaccine is the one you usually give to like kids, right? And it's actually a conjugate vaccine, kind of like the Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine. The PCV13, it's a conjugate vaccine. It's usually conjugated to like the diphtheria toxoid, okay? And it's a pretty good vaccine. Contrast that with the PPSV23. So this one contains like 23 capsular like serotypes, and this one is usually given to adults, right? So like adults over the age of 65. And classically, right, if you're a person that has like chronic disease like AIDS, like HIV, or you have diabetes, or you have kidney disease, that makes you a candidate for strep pneumo vaccination. So it's just, again, weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind with strep pneumo. And let's see, I think that's all I'm going to say about strep pneumo. Now let's jump to strep viridans, right? So strep viridans, the big bugs you want to know here, there's like strep mites, there's strep mutans, there's another one known as a strep sanguinis. I remember I said earlier on, right, that your viridans streptococci, they are optogen resistant and they can grow in bile, okay? But they don't have capsules. And remember, they're the most common cause, very high yield, they're the most common cause of subacute endocarditis, right? And the thing is, in general, you only get strep viridans endocarditis if you have like a damaged valve. If you have like a damaged heart valve, or you have like a prosthetic valve, right? You can get problems with strep viridans. Usually, if you have like a completely normal valve, you usually don't get endocarditis from strep viridans with that. The only thing that can torch a normal valve is Staph aureus. And the thing is, strep viridans, right? So classically, the way we present on exams is a patient that has like endocarditis after like a recent dental procedure, right? The reasoning, because you may say, Devine, why does strep viridans have this big association with the oral cavity? The reasoning is that, kind of like Staph epidermidis, strep viridans makes its own biofilm. Classically on exams, that biofilm, the bus phrase used to describe it, is like dextran. So that dextran binds very well to teeth, right? So that's why if you have like a dental procedure, you can get into trouble with the strep viridans endocarditis. So usually, if a person has like a bad heart valve and they're about to get a dental procedure like a root canal or whatever, I usually place them on some kind of prophylactic antibiotic so that they don't get endocarditis from strep viridans. And to be honest, I think that's all I'm going to say about strep viridans. So let's go ahead and jump to the beta hemolytic streptococcus. Real quick, just as a review, is there any other beta hemolytic bug I already talked about? I hope you're telling me Staph aureus. Remember, Staph aureus is beta hemolytic. So the beta hemolytic streptococci, right? So these ones are easy, group A strep and group B strep. Let's talk about the easy one first, group B strep, right? So group B streptococcus. Now group B streptococcus, right? It's beta hemolytic, so you have like complete hemolysis on blood agar. And there is this this antibiotic known as bacitracin. Group B strep or Streptococci is resistant to bacitracin. Bacitracin does not destroy group B strep. And then there is this enzyme that is expressed by certain strep species. It's known as PYR. I think the full name is like pyrrolidonyl arylamidase. Pyrrolidonyl arylamidase is not expressed by group B strep. Okay, so contrast this with group A strep. Group A strep is actually sensitive to bacitracin. So the antibiotic bacitracin destroys group A strep. And then group A strep is actually positive for this pyrrolidonyl arylamidase enzyme. Okay, it's just one of those weird things to keep at the back of your mind. And then, what are the higher things you want to know about group B strep, right? So group B strep can cause a lot of problems in neonates. In fact, here's what I will tell you. If you get an exam question that details a neonate, right? So by neonate, I mean the first 28 days of life. If you get a question about a neonate that has any kind of like major infection like sepsis or meningitis or pneumonia or anything of that sort, you really want to think about group B strep, Streptococci, as the inciting bug. Okay, basically group B strep is what you need to protect against in the first 28 days of life. Most common cause meningitis, first 28 days of life, group B strep, easy question. Actually, another question I have for you, what is the second most common cause of meningitis in the neonatal period? I hope you're saying E. coli, remember that's a gram negative. Another question for you, what is the third most common cause of meningitis in the neonatal period? I hope you're thinking about Listeria, right? So the mnemonic to remember those is gel, G-E-L. So group B strep is the G, E. coli is the E, and Listeria is the L. Those are the top three most common causes of meningitis in that order. So group B strep number one, E. coli number two, Listeria number three in the neonatal period. And then there are some other like weird tests you may see on exams for group B strep, like the ability to hydrolyze heparate, that's a property of group B strep. And then there's this test known as the CAMP test. Please don't think of CAMP as a cyclic AMP. It's just like a weird name that deals with like the people that sort of made up the test. But basically the CAMP test, it's like it's a test where remember I said that Staph aureus is beta hemolytic, right? The thing is, you can essentially increase the area of hemolysis surrounding Staph aureus if group B strep is around. And the reasoning behind that is the CAMP test, right? It detects like a CAMP, something called a CAMP factor. That CAMP factor, I sort of think of it as like a cofactor for sphingomyelinase. Sphingomyelinase is the thing that's expressed by Staph aureus that helps it with that beta hemolytic process. So the CAMP factor that's expressed by group B strep is kind of like a cofactor for that sphingomyelinase. So it increases the area of hemolysis around Staph aureus. Okay. And again, group B strep, neonatal period, bad infections. That's why usually if you're between like 35 to 37 weeks as a female, when you see your OB-GYN doctor, they sort of do a swab of your vagina to see if you're group B strep positive. If you are, they put you on like a penicillin, like ampicillin or amoxicillin, right? Because the classic means of transmission is the vagina, right? The vagina is how group B strep is transmitted from like moms to neonates. Remember that group B strep is encapsulated. I already mentioned that earlier. And yeah, I think that's all I'm gonna say about Group B strep. So now let's talk about Group A strep, right? So Group A strep is strep pyogenes, right? So strep pyogenes, again, super high yield bug to know about. Don't say, many people make this mistake on exams, right? So Group B strep is beta hemolytic. So many people say, oh, if Group B strep is beta hemolytic, that means Group A strep is alpha hemolytic. No. That is not a good knowledge transfer to make for exams. Group B strep is beta hemolytic. Group A strep is alpha hemolytic. Okay. So again, I just said the wrong thing. I'm sorry. Group B strep is beta hemolytic. Group A strep or strep pyogenes is also beta hemolytic. Okay. Very, very, very high yield to know that for exams. Now, Group A strep is a mega high yield bug to know for tests, right? So it's beta hemolytic. I already talked about it being bacitracin sensitive and being positive for that pyrrolidonyl arylamidase enzyme, right? And the thing is, Group A strep, classically, you get it through like respiratory droplets, right? You can also get it through direct contact, I guess, to a limited extent. Now, there are many high yield things you want to know about Group A strep, right? So Group A strep makes certain toxins, right? So it makes like streptolysin O, right? Streptolysin O is oxygen labile. Streptolysin S is oxygen stable, right? Those are two high yield toxins made by Group A strep. Now, it is very high yield to know that of those two, if you're comparing ASO, if you're comparing streptolysin O to streptolysin S, I say that streptolysin O is oxygen labile, streptolysin S is oxygen stable. It is also high yield to know that between those two, it is streptolysin O that is immunogenic, so you can make antibodies against streptolysin O. That's why you can measure things like ASO titers in the setting of rheumatic fever. It's very high yield to know that streptolysin S is not immunogenic, okay? It's just one of those bizarre things that you see on exams and like 99% of people get wrong. There's no something as an ASS titer, okay? It's ASO titers. Streptolysin O is the only immunogenic thing in that bunch, right? Now, what are high yield things Group A strep makes, right? So it makes like a hyaluronidase, basically that sort of cuts through collagen and like ground substance that surrounds the connective tissue. And then there's like M protein. The M protein actually prevents phagocytosis. The thing is, there are actually some, that M protein is kind of unique in the sense that it's actually used by certain like microbiologists to predict the a person's risk of getting something called a glomerulonephritis. I'll talk about that in a bit. But basically, the M protein, it's antiphagocytic, but there are certain M proteins, there are certain Group A strep organisms, right, that make certain M proteins, and those M proteins are associated with a higher than normal risk of a post-infectious or post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. Especially like the, if you want to memorize one for exam, like the M12, like basically any Group A strep that makes the M12 strain of the M protein, high strong association with glomerulonephritis. Now, Group A strep, it can also make like a pyrogenic toxin. That can cause like a scarlet fever, right? So scarlet fever, right? Usually they'll have like a sandpaper rash on their trunk, right? And those kids could also have like a strawberry tongue. And it is floridly high yield to know that on exams, the rash of scarlet fever spares the palms and soles, okay? The rash of scarlet fever spares the palms and soles. If you see a rash on the palms and soles on exams, right, you want to think about some other bugs instead of Group A strep. You want to think about things like the Coxsackie A virus, right? So causes a rash, and I mean that's why it's called like hand foot mouth disease, right? So Coxsackie A virus, Rickettsia rickettsii, that causes a Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and then syphilis, right? Like secondary syphilis is associated with a rash that affects the palms and soles. And then there is this rheumatologic disease, it's a vasculitis, Kawasaki's disease is also associated with a rash on the palms and soles. In fact, there's this mnemonic you may hear that you drive a Kawasaki cars with your hands and feet to remember situations where you can have a rash that involves the palms and soles, right? So the Kawasaki cars, Kawasaki is for Kawasaki's disease, and then the cars, the CA is for Coxsackie A virus, and then the R is for Rickettsia rickettsii, and then the S is for secondary syphilis. And it's just one, again, those were things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And remember, herpes strep, it can cause scarlet fever, it makes super antigens, right? So again, that'll bind to the T cell receptor and MHC class 2, and then cause like a non-specific release of cytokines that can put a patient in trouble. I mean, the mortality there is a super high. Remember, group A strep, right, can cause strep throat, right? So like pharyngitis, it's like you'll see like just whitish badness in the back of the throat. It can cause erysipelas. Erysipelas, classically, remember I told you that classically erysipelas are caused by group A strep versus impetigo, that is classically caused by staph aureus, especially like bullous impetigo, that's classically caused by staph aureus. Now, other high yield things you want to know about group A strep, right? So the thing is, group A strep can be associated with something known as first things first. I said strep throat. One weird thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with strep throat is that there's a certain criteria, they're known as the CENTAUR criteria. You can actually use those as clinical decision tools to sort of determine who has group A strep or who has a high probability of group A strep infection versus a person that has a lower probability of group A strep infection. So the big disease I want to talk about is rheumatic fever, right? So rheumatic fever, it's like a bad infection that can happen with a group A strep, right? Usually it will affect like a heart valve, classically it affects like the mitral valve, and then it can cause other problems, right? So it can cause like fevers, it can cause like joint pain, it can cause like a myocarditis, it can cause like an endocarditis, it can cause like a rash, like a red rash on the skin. It's called like erythema marginatum. It can cause just many problems. It can cause like a coryphorm movement. It's called like Sydenham's chorea. That's a classic thing. That's a real rheumatic fever. In fact, there are some criteria. They're known as like the Jones criteria for rheumatic fever. And the thing is, rheumatic fever can only arise after a strep pyogenes upper respiratory infection. If you have a strep pyogenes skin infection, you cannot get rheumatic fever after that. Contrast this with post-infectious or post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. You can actually get this after strep pharyngitis or like a strep, like upper respiratory infection or a strep skin infection. You can get it after any of those. Versus rheumatic fever that you can only get after strep pyogenes upper respiratory infection. And then another thing to know is that giving antibiotics actually decreases the incidence of rheumatic fever after a strep upper respiratory infection. But giving antibiotics actually does not decrease the incidence of post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. After like a strep upper respiratory infection. And remember that, again, if you want to sort of bring some immunology tie-ins here, remember that rheumatic fever sort of arises in the setting of molecular mimicry. That's like a classic cell physiology buzz phrase to remember for USMLEs. And usually rheumatic fever is an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. You sort of want to be able to contrast that with post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, that is more of a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction, right? So it arises from like the deposition of immune complexes. And classically on USMLEs, right, you'll be like 2 to 6 weeks after like an upper respiratory infection, you see a kid with like tea-colored, like, or tea or Coca-Cola-colored urine. Think about a post-infectious glomerulonephritis. And I guess just to sort of help you out here, there's some of these Latin words that sort of sound, you know, very similar. And then they screw people up on exams, right? So I just said that erythema marginatum is a classic finding in rheumatic fever, right? Please do not confuse erythema marginatum with erythema chronicum migrans. Erythema chronicum migrans is something that is observed with Lyme disease, right? Remember, Lyme disease caused by Borrelia burgdorferi and carried by the Ixodes tick. And then another Latin sounding word that sort of messes people off is ecthyma gangrenosum. So ECTHYMA and then gangrenosum. Okay, that's classically caused by Pseudomonas aeruginosa, right? That's like where you have like a black eschar caused by Pseudomonas. Again, remember, Pseudomonas is not the only thing that causes black eschar. Bacillus anthracis can also cause a black eschar. So again, just weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So I feel like I've said a lot of stuff about group A strep. So let's go ahead and move to gamma hemolysis. So gamma hemolytic strep, these ones are lower yield for exams, much fewer things to know about each. Again, like this first aid page says that the enterococcus species, they grow in 6.5% sodium chloride. And again, the enterococcus species are positive for that pyrrolidonil arylamidase enzyme versus your non-enterococcus gamma hemolytic strep that cannot grow in 6.5% sodium chloride, and they're not positive for that PYR enzyme. The big things I'll just see here is that enterococcal species, right? The big things you want to know is if a person has like endocarditis and they have like a recent, like GI, so like a gastrointestinal or like genitourinary procedure, and they have endocarditis, think about enterococcal species as the inciting agents. And the thing is, enterococcus in general, right? You can have like vancomycin resistant enterococcal bugs, VRE. You'll definitely want to know for exams that those are covered by linezolid. Remember, linezolid is a bacteriostatic 50S inhibitor. And then strep bovis is like a non-enterococcal gamma hemolytic strep. Remember, gamma hemolysis just basically means no hemolysis. The big thing you want to know about strep bovis is that if you find it in a person's blood, you need to work that patient up for colon cancer. Because like 20 to 30% of patients that have strep bovis in their blood actually end up having colon cancer. This is one, again, one of those bizarre things at the back of your mind you want to know for tests. So now that we've talked about that strep and staff and all that, and again, you may say, oh, Divine, wow, we spent a lot of time. This podcast should hopefully be over in the next few minutes. But let me just say some quick things about the other gram positives, and then that'll be it. And I guess I may actually not have the time to talk about the antibiotics in this podcast. Just go back and listen. If you just scroll on my website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, I have podcasts that are dedicated to the antibiotics. So I think you can get like a very full discussion with those. If I maybe have like 3 minutes at the end of this podcast, I can just say like high yield things about all the cell wall synthesis inhibitors and the protein synthesis inhibitors, but I probably will not, because I mean, I'm already at almost 58 minutes right now. Okay, so let's go to the bacilli, right? So we've talked about the cocci. So let's go to the bacilli, right? So basically like the upper part of this gram-positive algorithm, right? So the bacilli, so these are your rods, right? Your gram-positive rods. Easy way to divide those things up is, are they aerobic or are they anaerobic, right? Aerobic or anaerobic. So let's talk about those that are aerobic first, right? So let's see, how do I divvy these things up? In fact, you know what? I think to make this easy, I will see some high-yield identification things related to these gram-positive rods. Then I'll talk about each of them one by one, right? So first thing you probably want to keep in mind with these gram-positive rods are which ones make spores, right? The ones that make spores, just remember your B and C in the alphabet, right? So like your Bacillus species and your Clostridium species, those are spore formers. Remember, Bacillus species are aerobic, your Clostridium species are anaerobic, Okay, it's just, again, one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then just real quick, one other high-yield spore-forming organism you want to know for exams is Coxiella bonnetii. It causes Q fever. It's another spore-forming organism. And I said that, again, your Bacillus species are aerobic. Your Listeria species are also aerobic. Your Corynebacterium species, right, so the bugs that cause diphtheria, they are also aerobic. Nocardia, remember, it's like weakly acid fast, it is also aerobic. And your Mycobacterium species, right, so like TB basically, is also aerobic. And then the high-yield ones here that make exotoxin that you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So, like, obviously, your Bacillus species with, like, Bacillus anthracis and all that stuff, those all make exotoxin. Remember, gram-positives make exotoxin, right? So, like, your Bacillus species, your Clostridium species, right? So, like, tetanospasmin, the tetanus toxin and all that stuff, those are all exotoxin. Listeria, right? Listeria does make exotoxin. Remember, it loves to grow in the cold. And then your Corynebacterium, right? Your Corynebacterium, like diphtheria, the diphtheria toxin, the diphtheria causing bug also makes an exotoxin, right? Remember, like the exotoxin A that causes an ADP ribosylation. It's like a post-translational modification of elongation factor 2. And then the ones that are like facultative or intracellular that you want to know, Listeria is a big one you want to keep in mind for exams. Your Mycobacterium species actually facultative or intracellular as well. And then like the big one you want to know that is acid fast, right? I guess you can say it's like partially acid fast is Nocardia. For the purposes of micro, there are three organisms in general that are acid fast that you want to know for tests. The first one is Nocardia, is partially acid fast, it's an aerobe. The second one are your mycobacterial species, right? Remember, the acid fast stain is like the Zell-Nielsen stain. Your mycobacterial species like leprosy or TB, those are all acid fast. And then when you get to the purview of parasites, especially like AIDS, think about watery diarrhea in an AIDS patient. That's like Cryptosporidium parvum. That's another acid fast organism you want to keep in mind for exams. And then I guess if you're talking about like branching rods, you want to think about like your actinomyces and Nocardia. But remember, actinomyces is not acid fast and it's an anaerobe. Nocardia is partially acid fast and it's an aerobe. In fact, you know what? Let me give you a nice mnemonic. Think of it as Divine's ABC mnemonic for bugs that are anaerobic. Okay, so the A, think of A for anaerobe or A for actinomyces. And then think of the B as standing for Bacteroides, like Bacteroides fragilis. And then think of the C as standing for Clostridium. Okay, those are your anaerobic bugs, high yield anaerobic bugs for exams. So let's just go ahead and talk about the Bacillus species first, right? So the two big Bacillus species you want to know for exams, there's a Bacillus anthracis, right? And then there's Bacillus cereus, right? So B cereus. So Bacillus anthracis, right? So what are the high yield things you want to know about Bacillus anthracis? You want to know that again, it's a spore forming organism, it's an aerobe, right? And remember that it can cause like classically it's associated with like a postal worker or like an FBI agent or like a patient that sort of a person that sort of handles animals, like animal hide. In fact, that's why it's called like wool sorter's disease. Think about Bacillus anthracis with that. And Bacillus anthracis, right? The capsule is actually kind of unique, right? Because if you remember, I don't know if I said this earlier, but most capsules, in fact, I'll say pretty much every capsule of bacteria is made up from polysaccharides, but for Bacillus anthracis, it's very different actually. Bacillus anthracis, its capsule is made of polypeptide, it's made of like protein. I think it's known as like polyglutamate. Okay, so just one of those again, weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind because it's unique. And The thing is, when you inhale the spores, right, so you have like contact with like infected animals, that's how you can get Bacillus anthracis. Now, the thing is, Bacillus anthracis, the key things you want to know are that it can cause like a black eschar on the skin. It can also cause like a hemorrhagic pulmonary infection. In fact, classically on exams, they may talk about like a postal worker and they say they do a chest x-ray and you see like a widened mediastinum and the patient has been like coughing up blood. Think about hemorrhagic mediastinitis, classically caused by a Bacillus anthracis. And I mean, you want to know the toxins, right, that are associated with Bacillus anthracis. There's three of them, right? So one is known as edema factor. Edema factor is actually like a legit adenylate cyclase. So it increases your levels of cyclic AMP. The other one is known as a lethal factor. I mean, the name's sort of self-descriptive, right? Like lethal factor, lethal factor. I mean, it's not a good sounding name at all. So lethal factor literally is lethal to cells. And then there's something known as a protective antigen. It's the third sort of like member of the triad for the Bacillus anthracis exotoxins. The protective antigen, I sort of think of it as like a vehicle, like a bus or a car, something that sort of brings edema factor or lethal factor into like your human cells. Okay, anthrax is very, very, very bad. And I mean, how do we treat anthrax, right? You can give like a fluoroquinolone like ciprofloxacin, or you can give a tetracycline like a doxycycline. Those cover anthrax very nicely. And there's actually a vaccine, but it's not widely available. It's probably used mostly like in the military because anthrax could potentially be weaponized, right? As for like bioterrorism or something like that. And then the other Bacillus species you want to know about is like B. cereus, Bacillus cereus. Big, big, big thing you want to know here. Again, spore forming, all that stuff. I already talked about that. But remember, Chinese fried rice, watery diarrhea, and a ton of vomiting. Think about Bacillus cereus, right? I mean, the reasoning here is that one of the exotoxins it makes is known as like an emetic toxin. So emesis means vomiting, right? It causes a lot of vomiting. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've had this problem before. It wasn't Chinese fried rice, but it was like fried rice that I cooked at home and then I ate it and then I was just throwing up for days. This thing really sucks. Be serious. It's like a self-limiting watery diarrhea and vomiting, but it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. And it's, again, it's from a preformed toxin, kind of similar to like this, the preformed toxin the Staph aureus makes to cause a gastroenteritis. And again, yeah, it can cause diarrhea. The diarrhea is watery. And that's pretty much, I think, all I'll say about Bacillus cereus. And then I can talk about the Clostridium species, right? So remember, Clostridium is anaerobic. Remember, ABC, it's the C in ABC. Form spores, it's a rod. And there is actually a bunch of Clostridium species you want to know about for exams, right? So there's like Clostridium tetani. There's Clostridium botulinum, there's like Clostridium perfringens that causes gas gangrene, and then there is C. diff, right, Clostridium difficile. Now, Clostridium tetani, right, the classic thing you want to keep in mind for exams is like a person having like a puncture wound, right, from like a nail or something, right? You have that, and then the person has like spastic paralysis. Think about tetanus with that. And I mean, this is something that is vaccine preventable, right? So if you take like the Tdap vaccine or the Dtap vaccine, you can prevent tetanus. So how does the tetanus toxin work? It's an exotoxin because it's gram positive. The way it works is that it basically binds to like certain receptors on some interneurons you find in the central nervous system. They're known as like ganglioside receptors. When the toxin binds to those receptors, it basically prevents those interneuronal cells. They're called like Renshaw cells. It makes them not release GABA and glycine. Hopefully you know that GABA is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain versus glycine that is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the spinal cord. So when you bind to those ganglioside receptors with the tetanus toxin, you prevent the release of GABA and glycine. And if you don't have those inhibitory neurotransmitters, guess what? your skeletal muscle just keeps firing, keeps firing, keeps firing, right? So you get a spastic paralysis with that. Key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, right, is like some boss freezes for like the expressions you may see in individuals that have tetanus, right? So you may see words like rhesus sardonicus. Just look up pictures of these terms. You'll get the gist. Like rhesus sardonicus. There's like the arched back. I think it's called like opisthotonus. They have just bad spasms. I mean, these people usually, like, you can give them like a benzodiazepine to sort of try to calm them down and relieve their like spastic paralysis. This is a pretty bad infection. And really, the way you treat this is you give like a tetanus immune globulin to sort of bind up the toxin. And again, you can give like a benzodiazepine to sort of calm, relieve like those spasms. I mean, obviously, you should try to tell these people to, you know, get vaccinated at some point. So I guess that's all I'll say about Clostridium tetani. So let's talk about Clostridium botulinum, right? So the big things you want to know here, again, anaerobic, right? It's forms spores. I'm going to stop repeating like the anaerobic. That's why I made that summary at the beginning. But basically, this bug, it's very high yield to know that the method of transmission is different between adults versus kids, right? Especially kids less than a year old, right? So like infants. The thing is, infants do not have a robust TGI flora. So if they consume spores of Clostridium botulinum, those spores can germinate in their GI tracts like unopposed, make toxin, and then wreak havoc on that infant. Versus an adult, if an adult consumes Clostridium botulinum spores, they won't get any problems, because those spores cannot germinate in the rough neighborhood of the robust GI tract of an adult. As an adult, you need to consume like a preformed toxin of Clostridium botulinum to get into trouble. And that preformed toxin comes from like home canned veggies versus the spores in infants that comes from like honey. That's why if a kid is less than a year old, you should not give them honey. That's like a very bad idea. So how does the botulinum toxin work, right? So the way the botulinum toxin works is it basically cleaves like snare proteins. You probably remember this from like a cell physiology block, like V snares and T snares. So you basically do not send vesicles to the membranes of neurons, right, to release acetylcholine, right? So, and if you're not releasing acetylcholine, guess what? Your skeletal muscle is not gonna work, right? Because you need acetylcholine for those things to work, right? In fact, if they want it to be very evil on an exam, they can basically give you a question that talks about other like anticholinergic symptoms you get in the setting of Clostridium botulinum or toxicity, right? So you could get things like tummy upsets, right? Because your GI tract basically grinds to a halt. In fact, classically in kids on exams, botulism presents with abdominal pain, right? So like tummy upsets and stuff like that. Again, I apologize for the ums and ahs. Pretty much giving this lecture from memory. I'm just looking at the first data chart of gram positives. I mean, if you also have like anticholinergic toxicity or Clostridium botulinum, right, remember that your parasympathetic system causes mydriasis. So those people could have your parasympathetic system causes meiosis. So these people will have like mydriasis, right? Your salivary glands are stimulated by your parasympathetic nervous system. So if you're not releasing acetylcholine, right? You'll have tongue dryness, right? And then these people, right, they'll have a flaccid paralysis. And the flaccid paralysis is really descending, right? So symmetric descending paralysis that may ultimately require like endotracheal intubation. Think of that with Clostridium botulinum versus Guillain-Barré syndrome that you may see as an antecedent of Campylobacter jejuni infection that causes like a symmetric ascending paralysis, okay? Symmetric ascending flaccid paralysis. Think about Guillain-Barré syndrome from Campylobacter jejuni versus Clostridium botulinum, that you see a symmetric descending flaccid paralysis. And then contrast this with Clostridium tetani that causes spastic paralysis. Flaccid paralysis is Clostridium botulinum. Okay, so I think that is all I should say about Clostridium botulinum. Let's talk about Clostridium perfringens, right? Basically, the big thing I want to know about this is that it makes a toxin known as alpha toxin. That alpha toxin basically breaks down phospholipase C, right? In fact, sometimes you may see the alpha toxin referred to as lecithinase. It basically disrupts actin, so your cytoskeleton is gone, right? And you just get like massive hemolysis, so like your red blood cells just explode. You get like a lot of tissue destruction. Causes gas gangrene, right? So they usually show you like a nasty looking lower extremity that's like blue with like gas bubbles. Think about Clostridium perfringens. And one test you can actually do for Clostridium perfringens is something known as the Naegeler reaction. It's like N-A-G-L-E-R. It's just one of those things that will it show up on step one? Highly unlikely. But if it does show up, you'll probably be like the lone person that gets it correct. And the thing is, at the end of the day, if you're looking at those 265 or higher score ranges on the USMLEs, these low yield details then become high yield. If you're aiming for like the 250s, probably not a huge issue, but stuff like this can sort of put you in those very nice score ranges if you sort of commit them to memory. And then see perfringens, it can also cause can cause like a gastroenteritis, it can cause like a watery diarrhea. Usually resolves pretty quickly. And then I guess the association, you may wonder, like, Divine, how do people get C. perfringens, like diarrhea, right? Like, if you think of about, like, a reheated meat, like, let's say, like, a person has had, like, meat in their refrigerator for a long time, and then they keep, like, reheating it, they can get C. perfringens with that. And, I mean, usually you want to debride, like, tissue extensively if you see gas gangrene, right? That's pretty bad. I guess one thing I neglected to talk about with group A strep is that strep pyogenes can actually cause necrotizing fasciitis. Just one of those weird things to keep at the back of your mind. C. diff, Clostridium difficile, has the same identification properties with other Clostridium species. You know, causes a watery, foul-smelling diarrhea. And classically, it's associated with, like, recent antibiotic exposure, right? So the patient has, like, recent antibiotic exposure, and then you have, like, a watery, foul-smelling diarrhea. Think about C. diff. And the treatment, so this is actually one place you want to pay attention. Before, the first-line treatment for C. diff was metronidazole. That is no longer first line. The first line treatment for C. diff these days is vancomycin. Vancomycin is the drug of choice for the treatment of C. diff. If that doesn't work, you can give metronidazole, okay? If that doesn't work, you can give this drug. It's known as a fidaxomicin. Fidaxomicin. Okay. Guess what are some weird things you want to know about C. diff? You can sort of prevent the transmission of C. diff by hand washing. That's a classic question that shows up on the USMLEs. And I guess if you're going some more basic science here, you may wonder, Divine, C. diff, like, what's the toxin? It's actually like two toxins, right? There's like a toxin A and a toxin B. The thing is, I sort of think of the toxin B as the thing that binds to your cells for C. diff to sort of make its grand entrance. And then I think of toxin A as the thing that damages like your GI mucosa, right? So classically with C. diff, they see that it causes like a pseudomembranous colitis. And it can actually cause like a toxic megacolon, right? So if you see like severe abdominal pain, and then you get like an abdominal x-ray, and you see like usually on USMLEs, they'll show you like the transverse colon, it'll be like super, super wide. Think about a pseudomembranous colitis. I mean, think about toxic megacolon. Those people need to be taken to the operating room pronto. If not, they'll die relatively quickly. And again, so if you see antibiotic, and then a few days after starting antibiotic, watery, foul-smelling diarrhea, think about C. diff. Okay, and usually on exams, the inciting antibiotic is clindamycin. But the thing is, your friends at the MBME are realizing that everyone has memorized that. So clindamycin is almost never the inciting antibiotic for C. diff anymore. So yeah, that's all I'm going to say about C. diff. Listeria, so I'm done with the clostridial species. Listeria, big things you want to know, has like a tumbling motility. It's like an intracellular bug. It's like facultatively intracellular, and it can cause problems, especially in moms that consume like deli meats or like unpasteurized cheese. And then they deliver like a stillborn kid. Think about congenital listeriosis with that. In fact, there's a Latin term for that. I think it's called granulomatosis infantisepticum. That's classically associated with listeria. And remember, listeria is the third most common cause of meningitis in the neonatal period. And it is floridly high yield to know that the drug of choice in the treatment of listeria is ampicillin. Do not forget that. Basically, like, fuse that into your brain forever. It's a classic thing that shows up on exams. Listeria, ampicillin. Okay. And again, it loves to grow in like cold environments, right? So that's why like deli meats, you find listeria in those a lot. And listeria, another high yield thing to know for exams is that it loves to spread from cell to cell, through like, they call them like acting rockets, if you may. Just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, this is a low yield factoid, but it may show up on the USMLE. This is like a 270 kind of question. Basically, if they give you a question about a patient that recently had like a kidney transplant, or let's say it's a patient with like cancer and they have meningitis, you really want to think about listeria as the inciting agent under those circumstances. Like renal, like kidney transplant patients, cancer patients with meningitis, listeria is probably the most common cause of meningitis in that patient population. Again, weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. Now, Corynebacterium, this is what causes diphtheria. Remember, your Corynebacterium species, again, they are rods, right? They are aerobes and they don't form spores. Remember, spores are Bacillus, Clostridium, and Coxiella bonedii, right? So, Corynebacterium species, they don't form spores. They are aerobes. These are vaccine preventable, so don't be an anti-vaxxer. It's a terrible idea. You just kill your kids for no reason. Look at what is happening, I think, in like Washington State or something like that. It's not a smart idea. Just give your kids those vaccines. Vaccines don't cause autism. That's a lie that has just been propagated in the world of science and basically cost many kids' lives, unfortunately. So what are the big things you want to know about C. diff theory, right? So you want to know about its toxin, right? Exotoxin A. Basically kills elongation factor 2 through post-translational modification. That post-translational modification is like a ADP ribosylation. And remember, right, it can cause pseudomembranous pharyngitis, right? So they may describe like pseudomembranes in the back of the throat, like a bull's neck. That's the classic exam presentation. Usually it's like an immigrant, right? That does not have, they'll say, oh, has like an unknown vaccination history. If you see that, you really want to think about diphtheria, right? And the thing is, the toxin that, this is a weird thing you want to know for the USMLEs. The toxin, the diphtheria toxin, is actually not made by diphtheria itself. It's actually made by a virus that infects diphtheria. It's made by a prophage. Okay, again, weird thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And diphtheria, some, I guess, weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind is that there's this test known as the ELEK test, ELEK. It's a test that is actually used to detect diphtheria. And the thing is, the diphtheria infection, when it makes that toxin can actually spread to the heart and destroy, like basically cause like a bad myocarditis, and it can also spread to the brain and cause very serious CNS infections, right? So this is not something you mess around with. This is why you need to vaccinate your kids. And to be honest, I think that's all I'm gonna say about diphtheria. I mean, you can treat it with a macrolide like erythromycin or something like that. Okay. last things I'll talk about, actinomyces. Let me see, is there any other bugs I want to mention here? Talked about Listeria, Bacillus, Cyanobacterium. Talked about Clostridium. Propionibacterium, I guess they are calling it QT bacterium these days, causes acne, bad infection. I remember that Propionibacterium, or QT bacterium, I guess is its new name, is covered by your tetracyclines like doxycycline, minocycline, also clindamycin. Remember, that's a 50S inhibitor, covers Propionibacterium acne that causes acne. I guess now it's called QT bacteria. Actinomyces, remember, it's an anaerobe, it's not acid fast, usually causes like infections, usually like in the face, like the buzzword on exams are like cervical facial infections, and you may talk about like some sulfur granules. It's not like legit sulfur, it's just basically like dead actinomyces and like neutrophils. One weird scenario, though, you may see on exams with actinomyces is that it can cause infections in females using IUDs, okay? Like, if you see, like, sulfur granules, IUD, female, birth control, think about actinomyces as well. And then, the close cousin of actinomyces, nocardia. Nocardia, right? So, it's weakly acid fast, it's an aerobe, there's really not much to know about nocardia. I mean, you want to know that it is covered. You can treat it with Bactrim, so like trimethoprim or sulfamethoxazole. I think sulfonamides. Sulfonamides can also treat nocardia. But yeah, I mean, it can cause like pneumonia, usually with like cavitary lesions. Sometimes it can cause like abscesses in the brain. But to be honest, I think that is probably much too much to know about nocardia. And that's, I think, all I'm going to say about nocardia. There's also like mycobacteria, I'll probably talk about that in the gram-negative podcast. Because mycobacterial species, I mean, the gram-negative, there's not many bugs there. And usually for those, there's like just one or two things you need to know. But basically, I'll say I'm done with the gram-positives. I guess I'm on minute 86. Let me just say some quick things about the antibiotics. You know what? This will make this go on for too long. I think I'll stop here. I have dedicated antibiotic podcasts you can listen to. So I'm going to stop here. So just think of this as the rapid review of gram-positives. If you listen to this podcast and you digest it, make good notes. You should know pretty much all the high yield things that could show up on exams in relation to gram positives. So I wish you all the best on your test. And as I'm rounding up, I just want to say out loud, like I say at the end of every podcast, that I offer one-on-one tutoring for med school exams. Basically, every med school exam I offer tutoring for. I also offer tutoring for the USMLE exams. So step 1, step 2 CK, step 2 CS, step 3. And then I also prepare applications. So if you have if you're an undergrad that is applying to med school, or you know someone in that position, please send them my way. I do mock interviews. I prepare AMCAS applications. I help with personal statements and stuff like that. And I guess another high yield thing is I also prepare residency applications. So ERAS applications, mock interviews and all that stuff, recommendation letters, personal statements. I have tutored or prepared people for all those situations. I mean, I've been on an admissions committee before, so I have a lot of experience in these matters. So I wish you all the best. Hopefully you find this podcast to be helpful. Please share with your friends. And if you have any questions, reach out to me through the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, podcast with an S, or you can send me an email, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So have a wonderful day. Enjoy your Sunday, and God bless. I'll see you in the next podcast.